The Night Sky for July 2016. Well, I'm afraid there still aren't that many hours of darkness, but you do actually have a chance this month of spotting all five of the major planets, as we shall discuss a bit later. And what about the sevens that you do see? Well, looking over towards the west, you'll see one bright star. It's called Arcturus in the constellation of Bootes. Fairly high up, actually. Towards the south, it's a pretty open area. It's actually the constellation Ophiuchus, but there are no really bright stars there. But if you move over from Arcturus towards the bright star, you'll see a little bit to the east of south, which is called Vega, and again, pretty high up. In between the two, there's a constellation of Hercules. I'll come back to it a little bit later. Vega is one of the stars that makes up what's called the Summer Triangle. Below Lyra, its constellation, is the constellation of Aquila, and the bright star there is Altair. And over and up a little bit from Vega, you see a bright star called Deneb, which is the tail of Cygnus the Swan. So those three stars make up a very nice triangle, as I said, the Summer Triangle. And that's a lovely part of the sky to actually look at. There are lots of nice features there. The Milky Way runs along through Cygnus, and there's something called the Cygnus Rift, which is a rather dark region of the Milky Way. One thing you see against almost the darkest part is partway between Altair and Vega. If you go about a third of the way up between the two with binoculars, you should see what is called the coat hanger, or Brocky's cluster. And it just looks like a little upside-down coat hanger. It's a very nice thing to see. Rather sweetly, just down to the lower left of Cygnus and up to the left of Altair, is in fact a baby constellation called Delphinus the Dolphin. A little sort of well, there's four stars making up the head and another two stars making up the tail. So those are the main stars to see. The Plough is up in the northwest at the moment, and opposite Polaris, again right up in the north, a little bit to the east, is Cassiopeia, if you have a good northern horizon. And rising later is in fact the Square of Pegasus. So that's a fair number of things to actually look for in the sky. What about the planets? Well, Jupiter, the first we could see. It's seen low in the western sky after sunset, shining at magnitude -1.9, with an angular diameter still of 34.3 arc seconds. Those obviously dropped during the month, down to -1.7 magnitudes and 32.1 arc seconds. About 1 hour after sunset, it'll be about 30 degrees above the horizon, so it's still fairly visible, and high enough to see some of the details on the surface, the equatorial bands, and you should see up to four of the Galilean moons. The great red spot, which actually is getting smaller, will be somewhat harder to spot unless the seeing and the transparency of the sky are good. Jupiter passes half a degree below the fourth magnitude star Sigma Leonis on July the 12th, and it's actually moving eastwards, nearly reaching the Leo-Virgo border by month's end. Well, Saturn was in opposition on June the 3rd. It lies some 6 degrees north of Antares, which of course is in Scorpius, in southern Ophiuchus, that rather bland part of the sky I mentioned earlier. It continues its retrograde motion westwards across the sky throughout July, narrowing its gap between Mars, which is now moving eastwards, from 19 degrees to 11 degrees as the month progresses. At the same time, the brightness drops a little from magnitude +0.1 to +0.3, whilst its apparent diameter falls from 18.2 to 17.6 arc seconds. Though only at an elevation of 20 degrees when due south at about 11 p.m. as July begins, and about 9 p.m. at month's end, the beautiful ring system, now at an inclination of 26 degrees, is still worth observing. Now Mercury passes behind the Sun, that's called superior conjunction, on July the 6th. But it should become visible, probably needing binoculars, about mid-month, when it sets about 45 minutes after sunset, and it actually will lie just half a degree above Venus. During July's final week, it'll be seen to the upper left of Venus and moves closer to Regulus, that's in Leo, until the two close to just 22 arc minutes apart on the evening of July the 30th. Well, Mars can also be seen in the south-southwest after sunset, up to the right of Antares and the fan of Scorpius. It halted its western retrograde motion in Libra on June the 30th, and so July will be moving eastwards into Scorpius and ending the month some 10 degrees to the west of Antares. As we move further away, Mars fades from magnitude minus 1.4 to minus 0.8, and the disk shrinks from 16 to 13 arc seconds. Mars will be due south, and so highest in the sky, at about 9:30 BST on the 1st of July, still not really dark then, and even though its elevation is only about 19 degrees, a medium-sized telescope may still be able to see or image details on the surface, such as the polar caps or Syrtis Major. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I imaged Mars using a webcam when it still had an angular diameter of 18 arc seconds. Visually, I could barely make out anything on the surface, but was actually very surprised how much became visible, having processed 1,000 frame video sequences taken through red, green, and blue filters. Well, Venus. Venus passed behind the Sun on the 6th of June. It becomes also visible in mid-month, low in the west-northwest, shining at minus magnitude 3.9 in the constellation of Gemini. It passes to the lower left of Pollux on the 13th, and actually passes through the Beehive Cluster, M44, in Cancer, on the 20th, ending the month 5 degrees to the west of Regulus in Leo. Finally, what about the highlights of the month? Well, July, it's still worth observing Saturn, but I would suggest you might take a trip to the southern hemisphere where it's wonderfully high in the sky, so the atmosphere doesn't limit our view. A small telescope will show the rings at a magnification about times 25, and at one of 6 to 8 inches aperture, with a magnitude of about times 200, coupled with a night of good seeing, will show the ring system in its full glory. Like Jupiter, it has belts, but their colours are very muted in comparison. The thing that makes Saturn stand out is, of course, its ring system. The two outermost rings, A and B, are separated by a gap called Cassini's division, which should be visible in a telescope of 4 or more inches aperture if seeing conditions are good. Lying within the B ring, but far less bright and difficult to spot, is the C or crate ring. Due to the orientation of Saturn's rotation axis of 27 degrees with respect to the plane of the solar system, the orientation of the rings, as seen by us, changes, and twice each orbit they lie edge on to us, and so can hardly be seen. This last happened in 2009, and they are now nearly fully open, currently at an angle of 26 degrees to the line of sight. They will continue to open until May next year, and then narrow again until March 2025, when they'll appear edge-on again. I mentioned earlier that it's a good month to find two nice objects in the sky, the globular cluster in Hercules and the double-double in Lyra. There are four stars that make up the keystone in the constellation Hercules, and two-thirds of the way up is M13, which is the best globular cluster visible in the northern sky. Moving over to Vega, and just to its left, is the multiple star system Epsilon Lyrae. With binoculars, a binary star system is seen, but if you observe with a telescope on a night of good seeing, each of those stars is resolved to be a double star, hence the name, the double-double. In early July, we still have a chance to see noctilucent clouds, also called polar mesospheric clouds. They're the highest clouds in the atmosphere, heights of about 80 kilometres. They're normally too faint to be seen, but they can become visible when illuminated by sunlight from below the northern horizon, whilst the lower parts of the atmosphere are in shadow. So on a clear, dark night, as light is draining from the northwestern sky long after sunset, take a look north and you might just spot them. On July the 1st, about 1 hour after sunset, Saturn and Mars make a nice triangle with Antares, just looking low towards the south. 1 hour after sunset on July the 8th, you'll see a thin crescent moon near Jupiter. You need a good low horizon in the west, and obviously a clear sky. On the 16th of July, after sunset, Venus and Mercury are just half a degree apart. You'll need a low horizon in the west-northwest. Venus, at magnitude minus 3.9, should be fairly easy to spot. And with binoculars just above, I hope you might be able to spot Mercury. On July the 29th, before dawn, there's a thin, waning crescent moon close to Aldebaran and the Hyades cluster. About an hour before sunrise, looking above the eastern horizon, you should, again if clear, be able to spot this thin crescent moon very close to the Hyades cluster in Taurus, in which direction you'll actually see the orange giant star Aldebaran. Some hours later, if you happen to be in the southern United States, it will actually be seen to occult Aldebaran. July the 30th, after sunset, again given a low northwestern horizon, you should be able to see Mercury just 22 arc minutes above the star Regulus in Leo. Again, binoculars will almost certainly help, but please don't use them until the sun has set. And finally, something on the moon. On the nights of July the 13th and the 26th, the Terminator lies quite close to two of the great lunar craters, Tycho and Copernicus. Tycho is towards the bottom of the moon in a densely cratered area called the Southern Lunar Highlands. It's a relatively young crater, about 108 million years old. It has a diameter of 85 kilometres and is nearly 5 kilometres deep. A full moon, the rays of material that were ejected when it was formed, can be seen arcing across the surface. Towards the north, in Oceanus Procellarum, is the crater Copernicus. That's about 800 million years old and lies beyond the end of the Apennine Mountains. It's 93 kilometres wide and nearly 4 kilometres deep and is classed as a classic terrace crater. And both, of course, can be seen with binoculars, but you can make out more of the details with a small telescope. So, quite a bit to look for during July. I do hope you have some clear nights and can see some of the things I've mentioned.
Clear skies from Space Place at Kāra Observatory in Aotearoa, New Zealand. My name is Haritina Mogoshanu, and tonight I am your storyteller from the Southern Hemisphere. In this podcast, I will talk about flying, since it is something I have always loved the most, besides the stars. This podcast is for Stephen, who also likes flying. I always look up for planes and stars altogether, and I've always been happiest in the air. And many times I forget that whilst I'm thinking that I'm sitting still here on Earth, yearning to be there in the skies, our planet is moving at an incredible speed. Moving, but in relation to what? This is a good question. Well, to start with a point of reference, Earth is hurling at 30 kilometers per second orbiting around the Sun. We could measure these orbits and birthdays, one rotation, one birthday, so it takes Earth a year to go around the Sun once. The Sun also revolves around the Milky Way at 250 kilometers per second. So that means by the time we blink twice, we already covered the distance from Wellington to Rotorua. Since our galaxy is larger than that, it takes roughly 230 million Earth years to go around the Milky Way once. So as a point of reference, one galactic year ago, the trilobites were swimming in Earth's oceans. The speed at which our solar system goes around the galaxy is not the fastest speed out there. According to Scientific American, the galaxies in our neighborhood are also rushing at about 1,000 kilometers per second towards a structure called the Great Attractor, a region of space roughly 150 million light years. One light year is about 9.5 trillion kilometers, so 150 million light years away from us. Now, in 1989, the Kobe satellite was sent in orbit around Earth to measure the long-diluted radiation echo of the birth of our universe, also known as the Cosmic Microwave Background Radiation, CBR. Kobe discovered that Earth is moving with respect to the CBR with 390 kilometers per second, and that is precisely towards the constellation known as Leo, the Lion. So for the first time, we have an absolute frame of reference, which is kind of answering the general question of how fast the Earth moves whilst I'm sitting still in Wellington, sipping what I think is the best coffee in the world and dreaming about flying. I said I will talk about flying tonight. So what are some of the wings in the sky? Out of all planets, Mercury, it's the winged messenger of the gods. But Mercury is hiding behind the Sun for the first half of the month. It will join Venus for the first half of July. Venus sets in the west about 25 minutes after the Sun at the beginning of the month, so might be seen from places with a low western skyline. Its setting time gets steadily later. By the end of the month, it sets more than an hour after the Sun. On the 17th, the two planets will appear close together. Mercury will be much fainter than Venus. On the 30th, 31st, Mercury will be passing Regulus, the brightest star in Leo. So all five naked eye planets will be in the early evening sky in the second half of July. Golden Jupiter appears in the north soon after sunset in Leo, and orange Mars in the northeast in Libra. Cream-colored Saturn appears below and right of Mars as the sky darkens in Scorpio. Because they were visibly changing positions from one zodiacal constellation to another during the year, the planets were named wanderers by the ancient Greek, which is what planetos, planet, means. Yet only Mercury had wings at its feet as messenger of gods, alluding to the fact that Mercury was shifting position very fast in the sky. In terms of starry wings, there are many creatures out there among the asterisms imagined by humans. I will start with my absolute favorite object, which was discovered only a quarter of a century ago. That is the Milky Way Kiwi. July, it's the time when the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, is climbing all the way to zenith, and from there, if there is a truly dark night, you can see the Milky Way Kiwi. Now, you do need a very dark sky for that, and you do need to know what you're looking for. Best you can see the Milky Way Kiwi in long exposed pictures of the night sky, but I have seen it with the naked eye from Lake Tekapo, Earth and Sky. Before I came to New Zealand, I have not known it existed. I've always thought that the dark patch I was looking at, if I was lucky enough to see it, was a dark horse. Suspended in the fabric of space, the center of our galaxy only rose about 30 degrees above the horizon where I am from, near the 45 degrees north parallel. Besides, I did not even know what a kiwi bird was truly, let alone a celestial kiwi bird. Then one day, I had the chance to meet Ian Cooper, one of the first New Zealand's film astrophotographers, which means that he started imaging the night sky on film. He told me how people were taking pictures of the night sky, aiming at the center of the galaxy, and lo and behold, as they were looking at the final result, a kiwi bird took shape from the dark clouds of dust at the center of our galaxy. Now, if you turn the horse upside down, which is how we see the sky here compared to the northern hemisphere, it looks like a kiwi bird. I mean, if you know what that is. Ian told me how 25 years ago someone came up with the name. It was during the height of film in astrophotography and before the rise of the internet, so it was a slow burner, as they say. It is thought that some independently discovered the little bird more recently and got all excited, understandably. It is a pity that we don't know who first coined the name Milky Way Kiwi, but that is how it was in the olden days when I was young, he said to me. It's not the first time when people see birds in the sky. One of my favorite constellations is called Corvus the Crow. I always think of it as the herald of Scorpius. I know that when I see Corvus in the eastern sky, Scorpius will follow soon. At this time of the year, just after sunset, Corvus is in the west, flying away from Virgo's arm towards Centaurus. To find it, look somewhere between Jupiter, located underneath Leo, and Mars in Libra. Near the tail of the crow lays one of the most beautiful deep sky objects, M104, Sombrero Galaxy. Corvus has four main stars. If you imagine them as an arrow, the star Algorab will be pointing straight at M104. The star Spica from Virgo, which is now halfway through between Jupiter and Mars, can also be a great visual aid to find M104, as the galaxy is a third from Algorab and two-thirds from Spica. Another favorite of mine is Cygnus the Swan. It's my home zenith constellation back in the Northern Hemisphere, where it is also known as the Northern Cross. Cygnus is juxtaposed on the Milky Way. Very low on the horizon here, its main star, Deneb, is barely grazing the Earth, looking as if it's a slow-moving flame that braises the land with the galaxy. It rises 1 hour after midnight, as seen from Wellington, New Zealand. A tad higher than Deneb, my favorite double star, well, actually triple, Albireo, it's resolved in telescopes as one aqua blue and one orange star. That's a sight worth seeing at least every night when Albireo is in the sky. Aquila, the eagle, it's another beautiful bird that flies in the northern part of the sky, low on the horizon, rising just after 8 p.m. Right at its tail, there is NGC 6751, a planetary nebula that looks just like an iris. Altair is the brightest star in Aquila, and it's on the Milky Way. Opposite Deneb and Altair, on the southwestern part of the evening sky, Sirius is setting, whilst Canopus is descending from heavens. In between Sirius and Canopus, it's the constellation Columba. The cat and the dog are chasing the dove, which is what Columba means. For deep sky observing, near Faet, the Alpha star, brightest star from Columba, there is a beautiful spiral galaxy, NGC 1808. Delicate and rich in optical double stars that we can see with the naked eye, Grus the crane is another bird constellation laying now on the southeastern horizon. From Capricornus, that looks just like a golf flag from here, hop two more blocks, passing another favorite star of mine, Formalhaut, the loneliest star in Piscis Austrinus, and then next stop south is Grus. I remember seeing Grus in a picture for the first time whilst Comet McNaught was here in New Zealand in 2006 and getting very excited about being able to recognize it by the multiple double stars in it. And since we are at the southern side of the sky, to be fair, as much as I don't like them, Musca, the fly, also qualifies for a flying creature. Near the Southern Cross, Musca looks like a patrullator, a small one peering inside the coal sack. At the end of its abdomen, NGC 4833, it's a rather nice globular cluster. Near Musca, Apus, the bird of paradise's name literally means no feet in Greek, as it was once wrongly believed that the birds of paradise lack feet. Apus is pointing straight at Pavo, the peacock, that is flaunting his feathers all over the south celestial circle. Next to Pavo, it's Tucana, near the small Magellanic cloud, NGC 292. Some spectacular deep sky objects near it are the famous NGC 104, also known as 47 Tucanae, but also NGC 362, another globular cluster, NGC 346 open cluster, NGC 290 open cluster, and NGC 265 open cluster. Tucana is neighboring Grus on one side and the Phoenix on the other side. Since Herodotus, the Greek historian, the bird of Phoenix was associated with the sun, a phoenix obtains new life by arising from the ashes of its predecessor, and it can live for 1,400 years at the time. Inside the constellation NGC 55, it's an irregular galaxy, and NGC 300 is a spiral galaxy. The main star in Phoenix, Anka, is almost halfway through Akenar and Formelhaut. And there is also a flying fish, Volans. Its tail is pointing at the large Magellanic Cloud, and its head is halfway through between Mia Placidus and Avior in Carina. And last but not least, I don't know for sure if unicorns can fly, but I thought I'd mention the elusive Monoceros, the unicorn, just in case. It is between Sirius and Orion, and its stars are so faint that I have always just barely made the shape of it. Monoceros is visible on the morning sky. Faint or bright, all these asterisms are made of stars. Tiny little shapes on the sky, in a world divided by mountain ridges and landmarks, they gave small patches. These have morphed into the traditional constellations. There are officially 88 of them, and they do not change with seasons or latitude, but they are small and numerous. Down under, however, in the outbacks of Australia, people had a different perspective. It is said here that astronomy didn't start with the Greeks. Thousands of years earlier, Aboriginal people scanned the sky using its secrets to survive the Australian landscape. They do have a total perspective on the night. There is an emu out there that covers the entire sky, made by the shape of the dark and lit parts of the galaxy. Look closely at the Southern Cross and you will see its head as a dark smudge tucked near the bottom left-hand corner of the asterism. Its neck passes between the two pointer stars, and its dark body stretches the length of our luminous galaxy. Maori too looked at dark patches in the sky. What we know as the Coal Sack, a dark region near the Southern Cross, it's actually a flounder for them. But a dark patch that looks just like a kiwi bird, that is something that perhaps not too many people saw coming. Not too many people from New Zealand, I mean, because as I have discovered, and I said before, being shown a kiwi bird, very little foreigners, and I'm not counting the tourists here, can guess what it is. It looks like it's not an easy task to be the Milky Way kiwi. After all, it carries the center of the galaxy on its head, right on top of the head of our imaginary bird, just like a crown. It's Sagittarius A, which is the home of a bright and very compact astronomical radio source at the center of the Milky Way, near the border of the constellations Sagittarius and Scorpius. Sagittarius A is thought to be the location of a supermassive black hole, ours. So the Milky Way kiwi does carry all the weight of our stars. Not surprising given what its equivalent on Earth, the kiwi bird, did. There is a beautiful Maori legend telling how the kiwi bird lost his wings. One day, Tanamahuta was walking through the forest. He looked up at his children reaching for the sky, and he noticed that they were starting to sicken as bugs were eating them. He talked to his brother, Tanehokahoka, who called all of his children the birds of the air together. Tanamahuta spoke to them. "Something is eating my children, the trees. I need one of you to come down from the forest roof and live on the floor so that my children can be saved and your home can be saved. Who will come?" All was quiet and not a bird spoke. Tanehokahoka turned to Tui. "Hey Tui, will you come down from the forest roof?" Tui looked up at the trees and saw the sun filtering through the leaves. Tui looked down at the forest floor and saw the cold, dark earth and shuddered. "Kao, Tanehokahoka, for it is too dark and I am afraid of the dark." Tanehokahoka turned to Pukeko, Pukeko, will you come down from the forest roof? Pukeko looked down at the forest floor and saw the cold, damp earth and shuddered. Kao tane hoka hoka, for it's too damp and I do not want to get my feet wet. All was quiet and not a bird spoke. Tane hoka hoka turned to Pipi Farauroa. Pipi Farauroa, will you come down from the forest roof? Pipi Farauroa looked up at the trees and saw the sun filtering through the leaves. Pipi Farauroa looked around and saw his family. Kao tane hoka hoka, for I am busy at the moment building my nest. All was quiet and not a bird spoke. And great was the sadness in the heart of Tane Hoka Hoka, for he knew that if one of his children did not come down from the forest roof, not only would his brother lose his children, but the birds would have no home. Tane Hoka Hoka turned to Kiwi. Hey Kiwi, will you come down from the forest roof? Kiwi looked up at the trees and saw the sun filtering through the leaves. Kiwi looked around and saw his family. Kiwi looked at the cold, damp earth. Looking around once more, he turned to Tane Hoka Hoka and said, I will. Great was the joy in the hearts of Tane Hoka Hoka and Tane Mahuta, for this little bird was giving them hope. But Tane Mahuta felt that he should warn Kiwi of what would happen. Hey Kiwi! Do you realize that if you do this, you will have to grow thick, strong legs so that you can rip apart the logs on the ground, and you will lose your beautiful colored feathers and wings so that you will never be able to return to the forest roof. You will never see the light on day again. All was quiet and not a bird spoke. Hey, Kiwi! Will you come down from the forest roof? Kiwi took one last look at the sun filtering through the trees and said a silent goodbye. Kiwi took one last look at the other birds, their wings and their colored feathers, and said a silent goodbye. Looking around once more, he turned to Tane Hoka Hoka and said, I will. Then Tane Hoka Hoka turned to the other birds and said, Etui, because you were too scared to come down from the forest roof, from now on you will wear the two white feathers at your throat as the mark of a coward. Pukeko, because you did not want to get your feet wet, you will live forever in the swamp. Pipi Farauroa, because you were too busy building your nest, from now on, you will never build another nest again, but lay your eggs in other birds' nests. But you, Kiwi, because of your great sacrifice, you will become the most well-known and the most loved bird of them all. Thank you for listening to the July 2016 podcast. Until next time, kia ora! And Kia Kaha from Space Place at Carter Observatory in the Southern Hemisphere.